I do appreciate the opportunity to speak this morning, and I hope that because you may not be in youth ministry, I hope you haven't shut out an opportunity. This is not just designed for those that are specifically working with teens, and I hope that you'll understand that when we get done. I also don't want you to be misled by the title and thinking that I'm talking about just a specific group of teenagers who have troubles, because all teens are troubled. Every one of them has issues, and if you've ever spent very long talking with them or being around them, then you know that is the case. The very meaning of the word adolescence means that it's a process of a child developing into an adult. Layman's term says that's called being stuck. You ever been stuck between a rock and a hard place? It's troubling, right? They're troubled because of the nature of the phase of life that they're in. I also want you to understand that their brains are still developing. Studies have shown that this, what they call the prefrontal cortex, the very front part of your brain, does not fully develop until around the age of 25. Insurance companies figured that out several years ago, way before many of us did. That's why when you turn 25, you probably saw your car insurance drop. I was really excited the day I turned 25, and my car insurance dropped. The only problem was my health insurance doubled that day, so I didn't really save any money. But the area of your brain, what it houses is your ability to make judgment decisions. That's why when you were younger, maybe you were 16 years old, you thought it would be really fun to go 110 miles an hour across the I-10 bridge. Now, you probably say that would be a death wish. That's why also more injuries occur to teenage boys after they say the three words, "Hey, watch this." And then they immediately find themselves in the hospital because their risk assessment has not fully developed yet. Also, another part that the brain houses that doesn't develop till later is their ability to process emotion. That's why anytime you're around teenagers, they're either on a really good high, they're up in their emotions, or they're at rock bottom. They're rarely in between. They're on like the Goliath roller coaster at Six Flags. You're either up or you're down, or you're quickly going down. That's the way that they are. They are either doing really good today, or 10 minutes later they're doing really bad and their life is falling apart. On the bright side of that, though, there's a lot of good things that come from that. They're passionate. You never have to try and figure out, do teenagers care about something? They're not inauthentic, as you and I can sometimes be. They're either all on board or they could care less. And they will make sure you know whether they're passionate or whether they could care less. Also, I think one of the good things that can come from their inability to assess risk is that they're willing to do different things. Where sometimes you and I are unwilling to change, they love taking chances. And so what I find interesting is that God has placed these young people in our churches. And if we limit them, or if we stick them in a room, and we don't integrate them into the church, we're missing a vital component for the growth of the church. We need more passion, right? We need to be more open-minded. We need to even sometimes take some risk. Now, did you ever hear the story or the best advice about how to raise a teenager? I heard this several years ago, and I'm getting pretty close to this stage of life with my children. So I heard, you know, when they're born, you love them, you nurture them. And about the time they turn 8 or 9, you put them in a barrel and you bore a hole in it. And that's how you feed them. And then when they turn 13, you plug the hole. Well, I've purchased the barrel and I'm getting ready to put my 8-year-old inside of it just to see how that goes. Well, I want you to meet Generation Z. Really fascinating generation. This is a group of young people born from the years 1999 to 2015. They are the second largest generation on the planet. There are over 69 million Generation Z members in the United States. They outnumber millennials by almost 10 million. And in fact, they are just shy of being the largest generation on the planet that you probably know as the baby boomers. And what's interesting is that they have grown up with technology their whole life. Their life has largely been shaped by the internet and by smartphones. In 2007, a major shift happened in our world with the introduction of social media. Any MySpacers? Anybody? Oh, yeah, that was pretty awesome. When you could put the song as a part of your profile, that was life-changing. And then in around 2010, it really exploded, and Facebook became at that time the most popular social media platform. I'm just curious, anybody on Facebook now? Yes? Your teenagers are not, okay? They got off when you got on. And so they have now moved, but social media has largely shaped the life of a teenager. Let's not forget about the increase in the number of kids who own smartphones. In fact, the average age a child is getting a smartphone is around the age of 10. You do realize that most of these children have unfettered access to the internet, that many of them do not have any kind of restrictions on any of their devices. And that's basically like handing a child a live hand grenade with the pin pulled and saying, here, be careful, go have some fun. It's only disaster waiting to happen. And can we just be totally honest for just a minute that we as adults have not done very good at teaching children how to be responsible with a smartphone? If you don't believe that, the next time you go out to eat, I want you to pay attention. A lot of kids are probably in school today, so maybe the next time you go to lunch on Sunday or go to dinner one evening, I want you just to pause and look around. I do it all the time. Pay attention to families. What are they doing? Are they sitting at a table and everybody's looking at a screen? And when you notice that, I want you to find out what are mom and dad doing. Because here's what you're going to find a lot of times. The kids are doing it because mom and dad are doing it. That we as adults are not being responsible in how we use social media. And it's not just parents. Can we be honest, grandparents, that it's even affected the older generation? Saw it the other day. My wife said, hey, look over there. I'm not going to tell you how old they are, but they were over the age of 50, no doubt. Probably over the age of 60. And both of them were doing this. So it's not just teenagers that are addicted to smartphones. It's a lot of us. And we also need to understand apps like Instagram and social media are largely shaping the way that teenagers are viewing themselves, the way that they're viewing the world, the way that they're, it's affecting their self-esteem. It's affecting the view of themselves, and it's affecting the way that they're seeing everything. Everything on these apps are image-based, and it's affecting their image of themselves and of their world. There's also gender identity issues that are on the rise, and Andrew did a great job yesterday talking about homosexuality, same-sex attraction, same-sex behavior. Beautiful lesson. I hope if you didn't catch it, please go back and listen to it. Very powerful, very informative. Terms like transgender and gender fluid are becoming more popular, and you're even starting to hear those terms coming from the mouths of teenagers sitting in our youth rooms. And let's not forget the effects that divorce and remarriage is having on children and having on teenagers. If nearly half of marriages in the United States are ending in divorce, then that's affecting a large percentage of young people. I polled my sixth grade Bible class at Mobile Christian, and almost half of them come from a broken or blended home. It has a major effect on them. Don't forget about the real struggles that pornography causes. The average age a child views pornography for the first time is 8 years old. That's my daughter. Why? Because they've been given full access to everything that the internet has to offer. Peer pressure to experiment with alcohol, drugs, sexual temptations, and even the newest one is vaping. You heard about it? Over 40 kids confessed recently at Mobile Christian School to vaping on a regular basis, 7th through 12th grade. It's a real thing. It's being pushed as an easy way. It's better than smoking. No, it's not. It's a gateway to cigarette and marijuana use and other substance abuses. And then let's not forget about the amazing number of kids who have parents pushing them to play sports every waking moment of every season so that they can obtain that college scholarship, because let's be honest, many of us are not preparing for our kids to go to college anyways. And eventually we want them to go pro because we're raising the next LeBron James and Steph Curry, right? And we want our kids to make the best grades, do all their homework, and somehow get plenty of sleep at night with activities that are keeping them out of the house till 10 o'clock or later each evening. And along the way, we drop in the fact that families are actually spending less time today than ever in engaged, meaningful conversation. Why? It probably has to do with all of those things that we just mentioned. And this is why from 2007 to 2015, the teen suicide rates reached its highest point in the last 40 years. In 2015 alone, over 2,000 teenagers took their own life. over 1,500 of them were boys. And there's an alarming increase in teen suicide among young women ages 10 to 14 that the CDC is also watching. This is the world our teens are growing up in. And if you take nothing else from anything I tell you today, I hope you take this. Teens are living in a world that is totally different from the world that you or I ever grew up in. I hope you understand that. That's my whole goal today in talking about ministering to troubled teens, is to get you to understand that teens are living in a different world than you or I. They're not just the same old kids. It's not just different exposure. It's a totally different world that they live in. I didn't grow up. I can remember life before a computer. I know I don't look that old, but I promise I am. I can remember operating in DOS, okay? I proved myself. I remember life before the internet. I remember bag phones. Those were pretty amazing. I could not believe we could make a call from a car while it was moving. So they are living in an entirely different world. We didn't grow up with social media. We didn't grow up with only the highlights. It's an entirely different world, a world for which they are ill-prepared and they are unable to navigate it. And here's the dangerous thing. If you and I are unable to help them navigate it, how in the world are we going to expect them and teach them to be spiritually God-dependent, reliant adults? How can we do it if we don't even understand their world? All teens are troubled. And it's never been more difficult nor more crucial that God's people step in and help young people learn how to navigate this world in a way that's healthy, biblically focused, and Christ-centered. So with all that backdrop, I want to jump in today. I want to give you some things that teens need to know, messages that we've got to give them, and then what do they need from us? Okay, what do they need to know, and then what do they need from us? These are not in any particular order of importance. Okay, these are just five things that I believe teens need to know, that they need to hear and need to experience. Here's number one. They need to know that they are worth everything to God. And here's why. They are setting their identity in something. We all do that, right? We set our identity in what we do. We set our identity within our family. And the problem is when one of those things or all of those things are taken away, it takes us away and we lose ourselves, and then we struggle to find out who we are. Every young person is trying to figure out who they are. If we can help them establish their identity based in God and what God has said and the way that God has acted in their life, then we can help them be way beyond anywhere that I ever was and maybe even you ever were. They need to know that they are worth everything to God. So I have this guitar at my house. I bought it when I graduated high school. I took all of my graduation money. It wasn't as much as I had hoped, but I took all of my graduation money and I bought a guitar. I love this guitar. I don't know that I'll ever sell it unless you offer me the right amount of money, and then everything has a price. So it's a Epiphone Les Paul edition. It's beautiful. It's a little acoustic, electric. It's got a cutout. It's a black cherry sunburst. You have no idea what I'm talking about. I'm just telling you, it's a beautiful guitar. Something to look at. Plays real good. Sounds beautiful. Okay, it's not a true Les Paul. It's kind of a knockoff, but again, I was a high schooler. I only had limited funds. I've owned this guitar since I graduated high school. I've always been proud of it, loved to play it. What if I offered it to you? I told you I'd sell it to you for a special price of $50,000. Any takers? I didn't think so. In fact, you'd probably laugh me out the door if I was serious. But what if in his last concert, Garth Brooks played my guitar? Played it, signed it, gave it back to me and said, here you go. I bet I could take it and I could auction it off on eBay. And I bet I could get close to $50,000 for that guitar. Why? Is it a $50,000 guitar? No, it cost me about $600. But because someone else put worth into it, now it's worth more. Because something is only worth what somebody's willing to pay for it, right? Our kids need to know God paid everything to redeem them. He spared no expense. Gave the life of His own Son. And that this message is not just a story that they've learned in Bible class, but it's reality. It's God telling them that they are worth everything. Here's a second one. Very challenging. They need to know that the church is a safe place. Now, I know what you're thinking. Oh, definitely the church is a safe place. I mean, aside from some of the incidents that have happened in churches with violence and all that, but churches are safe places, right? That's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about physically safe. I'm talking about spiritually, the church is a safe place. I would be curious to find out, if you were to ask the teens in your congregation, is this a place that you feel safe to grow, to fail, to stumble, and to doubt? Would you say that this is a safe place to do that? I would be curious to find out how many would say yes and how many would say no. I haven't done it. I'm just a little scared to find out, to be honest with you. I think we would be shocked at the number of kids who would say, no, this is not a safe place to grow, stumble, fail, and doubt. And you know why? This is my perception. Because they don't see from us a transparency that says it's okay to grow. They know that it's okay to grow. But to stumble, to fail, and to doubt. When was the last time they heard from us? I've got my own doubts. I failed and messed up. Or do they walk in and see the smiles and see lives perfectly put together, at least from the outside? What are they seeing from us? Are they seeing genuineness? What kind of example are we setting? What kind of examples are their parents setting? When was the last time they saw the gospel affect us and really get into our heart? When was the last time they heard us honestly doubt or honestly ask tough questions? Because if we're not asking them, it may be because we're not really growing. Are we providing them that safe place to just ask tough questions? And I'm not talking about just in their youth groups. We'll get to that here in just a second. I'm talking about within the church as a whole. I think they need to know that they are known and loved. And what I mean by that is not just that somebody knows their name, but that somebody is deeply invested into their life. And not just somebody. Actually, a study from a book from the Fuller Youth Institute, a book called Sticky Faith, said that every kid needs five adults actively involved in pouring into their life and showing them Jesus in addition to their parents. Every kid needs five non-family members actively involved in their faith development in order for faith to stick in their life after high school. What this means is that for years we got the youth ministry model wrong. I mean, like, totally wrong. Because for years the model was, we'll hire a young guy, he'll work with our kids, we'll drop them off, he'll have fun with them, he'll teach them, we'll come back and pick them up, and then we'll go home and we'll have spiritually reliant children. No, it didn't work out that way. In fact, we rode that model way past its overdue date. Thankfully, we're learning. Things are changing. Youth ministries are adapting. More adults are getting involved. Those opportunities are getting there. But kids need at least five adults who are actively pouring into their life. Who's going to be the five? It can't just be the college students. It can't just be the young marrieds. It's five in addition to their parents. Who's it going to be? It may be that it needs to be one of us. Every kid needs to be known and deeply loved. And not just walking in the door and saying, hey, Tommy, hey, Susie, how you doing? But actively involved in their faith development. Actively interested in their life. How'd your baseball game go? What's going on at school? What happened with your little boyfriend? Hey, I saw you and so-and-so look like you're having a little beef. What's going on there? I mean, actively involved in their life. Here's the fourth thing. Life online is not reality, but it does require responsibility. They need to know it. I don't know that they do. And here's why. They don't understand that life online, it's just the highlights. I don't post videos of my kids pitching fits. I don't. I wouldn't do that to them, but I don't want you to think that my children even do that. I want you to think that my children are perfectly obedient, that they always say yes, sir, and yes, ma'am, that they never roll their eyes at me, and that they always lovingly say, yes, Father, whatever you want us to do, that's exactly what we'll do. But they don't. I just don't share that with you in the times that they don't. So we make sure that the pictures are posed just right, that it's at the moments where everybody's laughing and smiling, and, you know, we're on vacation or in the grocery store, and, you know, my daughter asked just the right question so that I can make you think she's, you know, like so spiritually smart, and I've done such a good job as a parent to instill all these Bible truths into her life. And, you know, I want you to think that my life is perfect, that me and my wife, we never argue. I mean, not at all. We totally agree on everything. We've never had a fuss whatsoever, you know, and we love taking pictures together, and we're always doing something fun, and we have the most romantic marriage on the planet. You know, like, everybody knows that I don't. I'm not romantic, and my wife would be the first one to tell you. But that's what I want you to think. Well, when you watch teenagers, it's really funny to watch them take pictures. You got to be careful when you joke with them about this kind of stuff. But I do think it is fun to mess with them a little bit. When you watch them take a picture, it's not just a picture. It's usually like 20 pictures. And after you take the picture, they want to see it. No. My hair's not right. That was the wrong side of my face. Both sides of my face look equally bad, so it really doesn't matter which side you get. But they want to make sure it's just right. And it's not just the girls, it's the boys. That's the funny thing. That's where I like to really mess with them. Like, no, I'll do that one again. Okay, whatever. But the point is that they want it to be perfect. If you were to pick up your child's phone or your grandchild's phone and you scroll through their camera roll, you'll find a bunch of pictures that they never published, never posted, because it took them 27 takes to get the perfect one. And then they spent half an hour thinking of the right caption to go along with it. And rather than being involved in the moment, they're all putting it on their Instagram or Snapchat story. They're seeing things through a screen, because life online is their reality. They need to know that it's just the highlights. That when they see, when your granddaughters or daughters see another girl on Instagram, that her life isn't perfect. That her body isn't perfect. That her personality isn't perfect. That her hair isn't perfect. That when you got a young man that sees another athlete on Instagram, that his life is not perfect. He's got insecurities. He's got weaknesses. He's got vulnerabilities. Okay? They don't understand that, and they need us to help them understand that life online is really not reality. And here's the fifth thing I think they need to know, that life goes on. That tomorrow the sun will come up. Whether it's they just had a heartbreak and a breakup, whether a friend has done them wrong, whether they've lost a loved one, that the sun's still going to come up tomorrow. Again, they're unable to process emotions to the best of their ability. They need to know that experience plus learning leads to wisdom. Not just experience leads to wisdom, but experience and learning from it leads to wisdom. They don't have perspective. If you came across the bay today to come to spiritual enrichment, you possibly drove through the I-10 tunnel. I love using this illustration with teenagers. All of them live in the I-10 tunnel. When you get at the bottom of the tunnel, you can't hardly see a thing. You can see a little bit ahead of you, but you really can't see out of the tunnel if the sun's shining. You can see behind you, but your view is limited because of your rear view mirror. All you can see is what's right in front of you and a little bit of what's right behind you. You can't see that life is still going on all around you, right? There could be a traffic jam. You could be stuck in the tunnel for an hour and a half and you're like, what in the world's going on? If you could get in a helicopter and you could go up about 300 feet, you could see where the accident begins and where the traffic jam ends, and you could see that life is still going on. Cars are still moving past it, and now you know exactly what's going on. The problem is, they do not have the ability yet to rise above a situation and see that life continues on, because they don't have the experience plus the learning to gain the wisdom. It takes time to develop. And that's where we're able to step in and help them to see that life will still go on. Maybe it's through a personal story in our life of where we dealt with something very similar. Maybe it's just in some type of encouragement. Maybe it's in a hug. Maybe it's in sharing a verse. Maybe it's through praying with them to help them understand that life will continue to go on. That's what they need to know. But what do they need from us? I think four very important things. Simple. All one word answers. What do they need from us? They need us to listen. They're going to talk to somebody. Again, all teens are troubled, right? They're all trying to navigate their world. They're seeking advice from somebody who will listen. Now, who do you want them getting the advice from? A 15-year-old? There's a verse that I think about when I think of teens giving major life advice to other teens. Jesus said, if the blind lead the blind, both will end up in the ditch. I don't know if he had in mind teenagers giving major life advice to other teenagers, but that's exactly what happens. It's the blind leading the blind. And it causes massive destruction and chaos. But why did they go to their friends? Because they knew their friends would listen. Why didn't they think there were other adults in their life who would listen when they had hardship, when they had troubles, when they didn't know what to do? We can't totally pin that on them. They're going to talk to someone. Wouldn't you rather than talk to you or talk to their parents or talk to their grandparents or talk to some type of spiritual mentor in seeking major life advice rather than their buddy, rather than their friend? They need us to listen. And not just listen like when somebody's talking to you and you're watching TV and you're like, what'd I just say? And you're not really listening. I'm talking about like active, engaged listening. Emphatic, empathizing, sympathizing, listening. That's what they need from us. Here's the second thing. They need validation. I know their problems sometimes are not that big of a deal. But to them, it's a big deal. I know they're not paying bills. I know they're not providing for a family. I know they're not trying to retire. I know they haven't dealt with some of the things you've dealt with. I know that your life has gone on. Theirs, they don't know if it will. So for them, it's a big problem. When the little 15-year-old breaks your daughter's heart, I know you want to break the boy's faith. I totally get it. Me too. I've already said it. Somebody breaks my daughter, I'm breaking their arm. That's just the way it is. Don't mess with my little girls. I'll break you in half, okay? But I know that my little girl is one day going to get her heart broken. Now, I could step in and be like, darling, come on now. That little guy, he was a jerk face anyways. I don't know why you fooled around with him. I told you boys are worthless until they're about 25 anyways. One day you're going to listen to me. That's not validating their problem. That's saying dad doesn't care. That's saying grandma, grandpa, aunt, uncle, spiritual mentor doesn't care. That's what it says. Now, I'm not saying you blow it up and you make it into something even bigger. Oh, I can't believe they did that. We need to get them back. No, that's not validating. Validating is saying, that is a big deal. Man, how are you feeling right now? You know, I remember when that happened to me. Oh, that was awful. They need validation. They don't need us to downplay their problems. They don't need us to turn them into something that they're not. But they're real problems because they're their problems. My problems are real problems. Maybe not to anybody else, but to me they are. Our teens need validation. They need affirmation. They need to know that they matter. And not just hear it, but experience it. What are ways that we as a church are allowing them to exercise their value and importance in the church? How are we encouraging and allowing them to serve? How are we pouring into them? What things are we telling them? What experiences are we giving to them? Are we making them think that they are no longer matter, or that they'll matter one day? Or are we letting them know you're important and I'm glad you're a part of God's kingdom and you matter today? The best way to let a kid know that they're important is to show them, not just to tell them. They need affirmation. They need affection. They need encouragement. And here's the last one. They need guidance. And I put it forth for a reason. These are listed in order of importance. I think a lot of times we get them reversed. We listen a little bit and then we offer guidance. Well, here's what I think you need to do. They're not looking for that first. Anytime you got a problem, you're not necessarily looking for guidance first either. You want somebody to listen. You want somebody to validate you. You want somebody to affirm that you matter. And then you want the guidance. And teenagers are no different. They need direction because they're trying to navigate a world that they don't know how to live in. Which means that we've got to learn to understand their world as well to help them navigate it. And those opportunities will come up where we're able to provide guidance and direction for them. But it can't be the first or second thing we try and do. We've got to validate them and affirm them as important people. Think about it like this. Like an apprentice is learning from his or her boss, teens are learning from you and I. They're seeking guidance and direction in their life. And when we have shown ourselves responsible, and we've shown that we can listen, we've shown that we've affirmed them as valuable and important, then they will be receptive to the guidance that we have offered. When we allow them to ask hard questions that maybe even make us uncomfortable, then they will be receptive to that advice. Got a call last night, sixth grader, who said at dinner, "I don't know if I believe in God. Mom and Dad stressed a little bit. Not me." You know what I said? I said, "That's a good thing." Wait a minute, a sixth grader doesn't believe in God is a good thing? Well, I'm not saying that his unbelief is a good thing, but here's what is a good thing. He's questioning. He's saying, "I don't know." That means that there's an opportunity for him to really wrestle with it, chew on it, and decide for himself. Now, yes, Mom and Dad could say, "Well, in our family, we believe in God." Yes, you do, Mom and Dad. But the kids need to as well. At some point, they've got to take that faith on for them. Is that a safe place for them to wrestle and doubt and struggle just like you and I have? I hope we have, church. I hope we've wrestled and doubted. I hope you've had those seasons where you just didn't know and you questioned everything. I hope we never grow out of that. If we grow out of it, it's because we're just taking it on face value. We got to chew through some tough matters. We got to struggle with it because you only get stronger through struggling. And our kids need a place to struggle. And then when we've allowed them to struggle, then we can step in and offer guidance once we've listened and validated. "Why don't you believe in God?" "Well, I don't know. I don't know how all that stuff could be real." You're right. It is pretty crazy, ain't it? God creating the world, can't see Him. Jesus doing all those miracles, right? Validate. Affirm it. Man, I'm glad you're at this point. Now you can really wrestle with this, and when you come out of this, you will be more convinced than ever. You're way ahead any kids your age. Most of these other kids are just taking it in, you know, mouthful at a time of whatever their parents and other adults are feeding to them. And you're really trying to chew on this and wrestle with this. This is awesome. Now, I remember when I was your age. I remember a couple years ago, I was struggling with me. Really, you too? At, you know, late 20s, as a parent of a youth minister, you struggle with believing in God? Absolutely. You know what the hardest part was? Standing up and teaching at the same time. But I was wrestling because I wanted to grow. Oh, cool. Now they're open to hearing that guidance that you have to offer. Whereas if we just stand up and say, doubt, it's no big deal. No, it is a big deal. And it's a good thing because God can work through that. So teens need you. They need your guidance. They need your affirmation, your validation. They need you to listen. Doesn't matter if you're a 25-year-old youth minister, 75-year-old grandparent, or somewhere in between. They need your spiritual example. They need your advice. They need your guidance. They need your words of affirmation and encouragement. They need to learn from your experiences and your wisdom. But they need a relationship with you in order for that to happen. They may never walk up to you and say, "I want a relationship with you." But they crave it. They want it. They need it. And it's our responsibility to minister to every teenager, every child that's sitting in the pews in our church. Because every one of them is trouble. Thank you.